Welcome to Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy practitioner. I'm your host, Holly Waymont. I work for UT Health San Antonio's Department of Pediatrics. In this podcast, we explore how we can provide the best, most cutting-edge, compassionate care for children. We hope to give you a unique and behind-the-scenes edge from our expert guests. After listening, click on the link on this podcast for free credit that may include CME, MOC, or ethics credit, depending on the topic. Joining me back on the show today is Dr. Ed Brooks. He's Division Chief of Allergy, Immunology, and Infectious Disease at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. He also has 30 years of experience in this field. And Dr. Brooks, you were on a national panel that set these type of guidelines.
That's correct.
Thank you so much for being back here on the show. In the New York Times, it says spring allergy season is getting worse. Experts explain how if you have allergies and how to find relief if you do. Spring is here, and if you're among the estimated 1 in 4 adults in the United States who suffer from seasonal allergies, your sneezing and scratching may have already started. And with climate change affecting temperatures and plant growth, you may need to be on the lookout earlier than ever before. And they do mention that allergy season is lasting longer, and they do talk about Texas there. What do you want to say about these pollen allergies right now?
Well, unfortunately, you know, San Antonio has been like this for some time. So,
yes,
grass pollens are pretty much year-round. We have winter grasses through the winter. And because we have such mild winters, other than when we get a really not mild week, a very cold week, the rest of the time, you know, the weeds and grasses are growing. But we mainly get grass pollens. And, of course, San Antonio is unique with the mountain cedar that pollinates in the winter. That's normal for it. But there's a lot of research showing with increased CO2 levels, some plants respond to that by producing more pollen. And the warmer, longer growing periods, you know, you're gonna get more pollen. That's just sort of nature's way, if you will. And so it's slow, though. It's not that dramatic, but it's, you know, over decades, it's may have an effect on the amount of pollens, et cetera. The other thing, you know, that why do we have so many people with allergies? That seems to be a bigger problem with no easy solution, in the sense that the what we call the hygiene hypothesis and the microbiome research that's been done as to why we have more allergic disease in general. It's because allergy is not anything about the environment change. It's about our internal environment, if you will. It's the immune system. And if we're too clean, that's the bottom line. You know, humans, if you think about it, over the last few hundred years have evolved out of throwing the chamber pot out the window. You know, we lived in a cesspool. But that
I had one of those. She was telling us about the she was, because of her age and the family, it was her job on certain days to take out the chamber pot.
Wow. next- So our avoidance of the outdoors, being exposed to the natural environment, and, you know, it's not changing. You know, there's more and more people living in cities, but, and there eventually will be, you know, people take probiotics and all of this stuff, and there may be some advantages to that and how the diet that we eat. But in general, as humans, our immune systems evolved throughout, you know, the eons to fight off a lot of microorganisms in the environment. And if we're not exposed to those, you know, there's good bugs and bad bugs, but if we're not exposed to those, our immune system doesn't develop properly. And the result is it tends to bias towards this allergic response. And so that's not going to change, probably. But, you know, I tell people, go to the park and roll the kid in the dirt. You know, we ate mud pies when I was little, and it turns out that may not be such a terrible thing. My favorite study that I quote, and really, you know, people have studied the effect of animals, and it's having dogs and even cats in some studies early in life has a protective effect on children having allergies. And the reason for that is they're dirty. You know, as one scientist said, they don't wipe.
Right. And
so those microorganisms turn out to be beneficial. And they did a study with dogs and frequent colds in children. So the basis is the same. If the immune system doesn't develop properly, you may have more colds and develop allergy. And that's why when the babies constantly have a runny nose, people say, oh, it's their allergies. It's, no, it's an infection, but it's the same basis. The immune system is biased. But the children that, you know, raised with dogs have less of those colds. And they went one step further. They said, is it indoor dogs, outdoor dogs, or the dogs that go in and out? And the answer is?
The dogs that go in and out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the theory is that they're bringing in the natural environment that people can develop, you know, a better immune system. So on the one hand, these microorganisms, some of them are bad and kill us. Most of them are pretty good. And it's a delicate balance between you don't want your child outside eating dog poop that has worms. But at the same time, you do want them exposed to the natural environment and those dirt bugs, if you will. And helping to develop their immune system. So
my daughters and I go ride horses about once a week in Bull Verde, and there's got to be some dirt involved there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, humans have evolved with their farm animals for God knows how many thousands of years. And so we've co-evolved. And so our immune systems are very well adapted to that. And we sort of removed a lot of that natural environment or, you know, farm environment from our exposures. And so there's, unfortunately, the adjustment is we have more, all of a sudden our immune system seem to recognize animal dander or pollens as enemies and try to fight it. And so it's just an abnormal immune response. And the same goes for certain viruses. We don't seem to fight off the certain viruses as aggressively or as efficiently as we would if we were living in a dirtier environment, if you will.
So are you talking about like cold viruses or
GI? Yeah, common colds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when a child has an exacerbation, ends up in the hospital, I guarantee it's a virus.
Mm.
It's not because of allergies. Allergies can cause anaphylaxis, you know, a true allergic reaction like a food anaphylaxis or a pet anaphylaxis, less common. But And the most common virus is called rhinovirus. And the younger children get something called RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus. And there's others that do it, parainfluenza virus and metapneumovirus, but not the coronaviruses. You know, the common cold coronaviruses that everybody knows about now, we know about coronavirus, actually have play a role in exacerbations of childhood arthritis, a little bit different disease, but similar pathway.
The coronavirus does?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that isn't childhood arthritis, while still rare, it's on the rise?
It is on the rise, and probably from some early studies, similar findings that their intestinal microbiome is less diverse.
Hmm.
So the more diversity you have, diversity is a good thing. More diverse you are, the less likely you are to develop allergic disease. And so, that same theory is starting to come out in juvenile arthritis as well.
And you
so
see,
again, you're kind of immune dysregulation. Both of them are diseases of immune dysregulation.
And I know you see patients for that condition as well.
Right.
Is this also another case for, say, getting that hamster or guinea pig that your child is begging for?
I would say yes. Obviously, once you're sensitized, like you have an allergy to mice, obviously you're better not having a guinea pig in the house or, you know, playing with the mice. But prior to that, so the vulnerable period appears to be early life exposure seem to predict these things. So in the first 3 years of life, being exposed to pets and the natural environment seems to be beneficial. And you think about it, what's the most sterile period of a baby's life? That first year.
Right. And of my three children, my son is the only one where we didn't have a dog when he was a baby, and he's the only one who has allergies. So
N of one.
Yeah. do you recommend in general though, for all of us, for our health, pets are good for us. If you like animals, they are good for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a good pet lover. I think so.
So
I think, our immune systems, again, I think in evolution, we evolved with our dogs and our pets and our farm animals. And I think our immune systems are somehow in sync with those animals.
And you also recommend using the least amount of soap as possible, as only as necessary, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the mom running around with the sterile wipes and wiping everything the baby touches is probably overdoing it. And there's a series of nice studies that the first child born is the one most likely to develop allergies. But the more children in a sibship, they tend to have less and less allergy. And think about it, after you've got a house full of kids, it ain't clean.
Right.
And the first kid, a new parents are really anxious and, washing the binky off every time it hits the floor. And then after a while, you're just like, just stick it back in their mouth and don't worry about it. So
yes.
I think we're a little, now I'm also done a lot of toxicology research, and I worry about the chemicals we bring into our homes. And so I tell parents, don't use all the strong Mr. Clean and all that stuff on your floor, because where's that baby?
Mm-hmm.
Down on the floor. Kids are down where our feet are. And some cultures, take their shoes off when they come in the house. Americans don't. So whatever poisons and toxins people have sprayed all over your work, or we just walk right in the house and spread it around. So I think there's some potential risk there. There are not good studies to point to that directly, but use of pesticides and herbicides in some studies it's shown to increase the risk for development of allergic disease.
So in your home, do you recommend taking off your shoes before entering and a certain type of floor cleaner?
Yeah, water.
Yeah, just keep it plain water if possible.
Yeah, plain water is fine. But if you have to use a cleaner, then, if you're cutting up raw chicken, you do want to use some disinfectants on the surfaces. You don't want to spread salmonella around. But there's not a lot of other situations. I have yet to see a child that got sick from a dirty dish, but if you ask my wife, she rewashes dishes because she can see it, see I didn't do a good job. But I think in general, there's very low risk dirt, so to speak, in our environments. And what we consider dirty is actually somewhat beneficial, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you take, And I tell them, don't use pesticides and herbicides in the house, because guess what? That's going to make it inside the house. And right. Children get exposed to that. Children are more vulnerable. At a certain age, they stick everything in their mouth, right?
Right.
And, we're always reprimanding them. But in a way, there hasn't been any good research on this, but a child sampling the world with their mouth, maybe an evolutionary way of getting used to the natural environment, because the immune system has to learn what's normal so they can distinguish between that and a real, a threat,
mm-hmm.
an infection that's going to kill them. Most of the bacteria and fungi, things that are in our gut and they're in the environment and they're harmless and actually help shape the immune system. It's just a delicate balance now, because we've got lead in the soil from old lead-based paint. We've got all kinds of junk we spray in our yards. And then out there in the world, there's no controls on the chemicals people use for cleaning. I've had several patients have severe asthma exacerbations after going into a restroom where they just clean. So toilet bowl cleaners and things like that. A lot of these chemicals can trigger a severe asthma exacerbation.
Mm-hmm. And so do you recommend, though, if people feel comfortable doing so, take off shoes before you enter a house?
I think that's a reasonable, but it's cultural. It's hard to tell people that, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's a cultural thing. And I just think the shoes you've worn all over the street and, where cars are and all the oils and chemicals that people are using to kill weeds in the sidewalks and spraying pesticides everywhere, you bring traces of that into your home. Mm-hmm. So I think it's reasonable not to wear your street shoes all around your home, but it's a cultural thing.
That's great advice, though. So, and Dr. Brooks, do you, for our pediatric practitioner listeners, do you have any advice about the pollen allergies in particular now? Is there anything new or the top three things to be saying to patients to help them?
Once you develop sensitization, it's hard to manage it. You know, parents ask me, well, asthma in general gets better in teen years and naturally. And it comes back when you're older, but in childhood, you know, teenagers have fewer problems in general. Eczema tends to get better, you know, start off in early childhood and then it tends to improve after a few years naturally. Allergies tend to come and stay. They don't tend to go. And the more you get, the more you're going to get. So what I mean by that is children may start out with, and typically indoor allergens like dust mite. That's the most common. Over time, they start to develop pollen sensitivities. So there are some, you know, I wish it was FDA approved therapy, but the sublingual, you know, the allergy drops have been, allergists have been doing for hundreds of years.
Yes.
Are effective. And, you know, shots work very well, but how many babies you want to put on shots? It's pretty harsh. So there's these new sublingual tablets that one is a grass tablet and one's a ragweed, and those are approved down to 5. And the dust mite tablet is now approved. Well, it's just approved at 12. They say they're going to go down lower. But I think those are really good therapies. And if you treat with immunotherapy early on, the likelihood of them continuing to advance their allergies is much lower. So it helps the asthma. It helps their allergies. It reduces the progression of allergy. You know, you've heard a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, they test me and I'm allergic to everything. Well, children can only be allergic to a few things. And if you treat that early on, it's less likely to progress to I'm allergic to everything. Mm. So early intervention. So ideally, we'd be giving very young infants sublingual therapy. It's just not, insurance won't pay for it. And that's sort of the allergy drops. It's the same thing we give in shots. And I've used them in patients effective. But it's not FDA approved. Insurance won't pay for it. And so it's all out of pocket. And these allergy extracts are quite expensive. And as one CEO of an allergy company said, we're just providing what people didn't get when they were children. In other words, exposure to the natural environment, natural desensitization, you know, teaching the immune system that pollens are okay and dog dander's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Something to be said for that. So treating it early with immunotherapy is very effective. It's just pragmatically difficult. You know, either you go in frequently for allergy shots, or if you have the money, you pay for the drops. And hopefully they'll develop more of these sublingual tablets where we can treat young children early on and nip it in the bud, so to speak.
So, for example, and before we wrap up, so for my son who has pollen, the oak pollen allergies, and well, it's pretty specific, but are the shots more effective than the sublingual drops?
We have less experience with the sublingual, and that's just the nature of the industry and the fact that it's not FDA approved, so we don't get big studies. I treated my son with the drop, and he had severe cat allergy and mountain cedar, and now he doesn't have either. He's got a cat, in fact.
Nice.
And some people ask me, well, once you have cat allergies, is it better or worse to have cats? And so I quote a study in which they studied people who had lots of cats. I call them weird cat people, you know, with too many cats. And they studied their blood, and they... So we do testing, it's the IgE, And that's all we have available really commercially. There's no other good tests available. Research-wise, we can measure a lot of different factors that point towards benefit, or what we call the protective immune response. In other words, when I put someone on allergy shots, it may take several years before that allergy test, that skin test, goes away. But if I could take their blood to the laboratory, I could show a lot of other immune factors, and one of them we call blocking antibodies. So after exposure to these things, the immune system develops blocking antibodies, and those block the immune response to allergies. And they studied these weird cat people, and they hadn't been on shots, but their blood factors looked as if they'd been on allergy shots. The same with beekeepers who get stung all the time. They have these protective factors, so they don't develop allergy because they get stung all the time. It's like getting allergy shots.
Wow. But for in the case of my son, Liam, though, so he could take the sublingual drops, because he's been asking me about, do I really need shots for the oak pollen?
Right. Every kid has the same response. And yes, he could. And UT is a little cumbersome, and private practice is a lot easier, but I have to get approval for each patient that wants to go on sublingual drops. And we basically charge the cost of the extract. In other words, you know, whatever we buy the extracts for, it's not inexpensive. Now, oak is not bad. Cat's very expensive. So people with cat allergy, you know, it's hard to do, because they'd be paying like $200 a month just for their drops. Because with sublingual, you have to go much higher on the dose, much higher before you get the benefit. The shots, you know, are cheaper in that context because you use much less of the extract. But the drops, you got to use a lot of it. It's also sort of it's not standardized. The studies that have been done, which are not that many, use standardized. They measure like the major proteins in there, and then they equate the dosing with that. Well, I don't know what that is in most extracts. I don't have that. They don't provide that information. They're what we call non-standardized. It's just take a bunch of pollen and extract it, and it's a ballpark. You know, so we have to be very careful with shots because it could vary in potency. But the drops are safer. You do have to do them every day. But they work.
The shots can vary in potency, or the drops, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why we have to be very careful with giving shots, because when we're desensitizing, people can, we're giving what you're allergic to, and they can have a full-blown anaphylactic reaction to the injection. So we have to be very careful and slowly build it up. Immune deficiency, that's a whole nother topic. That's immune deficiency are those, like the bubble boy, you know, that have too many infections, too many pneumonias, have an immune defect in there. And so they're the kids that catch everything, end up on antibiotics constantly, and may need to go on gamma globulin replacement therapy. You know, the treatments are pretty straightforward, but how to recognize those patients and get them to us so we can evaluate them is important, I think.
And that's a big thing I get, you know, so many pediatricians, pediatric practitioners, so much is coming at them. And the worry is, of course, not to miss anything. So how would you know if a child would need to see you for this? What would be the top warning signs?
I would say need for antibiotics more than like 5 or 6 times a year. You know, that's a real red flag. Pneumonias in children. And then there's an old saying that any child with a severe infection ends up in the hospital with some terrible infection deserves an immune evaluation. But usually it's the kid with, you know, constant runny nose, et cetera. And I think pediatricians are pretty good at this. They recognize, okay, the first time they go to daycare or first year of school, let's say they've kept it home and they really don't have any exposure, they haven't caught anything. And then all of a sudden they go to school and they're sick as dogs.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably normal. you know, they go through a period, and how sick are they? They have a constant running nose. Well, that's natural for kids. They're going to catch all those colds. They're going to be sick all the time. And so I'll give you an example. After the shutdown, you know, during the shutdown, nobody caught anything, right? They're all at home. Very few other colds and viruses going around. We're all afraid of COVID. And then after, when the schools forced everyone back to school after a year and a half, that fall was a bad fall. There was headlines about rhinovirus and RSV and all these terrible viruses. Well, these are the same viruses that have been around. They hadn't changed. What it had changed is exposure. Nobody had been exposed to these viruses for a year and a half, and their immunity probably had waned. And all of a sudden, they're getting sick again. And a lot of people sent their kids, a lot of pediatricians sent their kids to me and Dr. Infante, and we studied their immune system, and they're fine. And this was just a phenomenon of exposure. So it's a combination, you know, in diagnosing these diseases. It's a combination of exposure. I've had kids who are very immune deficient and never got sick. Why? Because they kept them in a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't exposed to the common cold. They weren't in general school. There's a lot of more online school and homeschooling going on. So all that becomes very important in understanding whether this is normal and they got a lot of colds and they're getting over them on their own. So that's important. You know, you get a cold and you recover after a week, and or you get a cold and every single time you get a cold, you end up on antibiotics because you got a bad sinus infection or ears or, you know, ear infections, and particularly pneumonias. Those more severe infections really catch our attention because it's not normal.
And what and then if a child is found to be immune deficient, what do you do then? What's the treatment?
Well, it very depends on the types of infections, and the more common immune deficiencies are antibody deficiencies. So, you know, we're not making enough good antibodies. So the easy thing that we do is we put them on preventive antibiotics. It's sort of a weaker antibiotic, and we give it at a lower dose a few times a week. And it works really well at preventing those viruses from turning into a bacterial infection. I tell all my allergy patients to stop their antihistamines. Because why? Well, because you want that stuff to drain out if you have an infection. Again, I think there's a bias in our community that every time their nose runs, it's allergy.
Right.
So they treat them with allergy. And the doctors are sort of, or they take over-the-counter medications, or the doctors put them on an antihistamine, even the very young children. And I'm sort of against regular antihistamines. It's okay to take one here and there for itchy, sneezy. That's what they're good for. And even if you have a bad cold, you know, a Benadryl at night will help you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But taking them regularly every day, or even for colds, I think is counterproductive. It makes it look good on the outside, but it doesn't really help you get over it.
Mm-hmm. Is Dr. Briggs, is immunodeficiency on the rise, or are you saying we just need to be more conscious of it so we can identify these children and they can get the care they need?
Right. I think because of the genetic revolution, we're able to identify. So there's a condition called common variable immune deficiency. It's very common, quite variable. It's sort of that wastebasket. We don't know what they have, so we call it common variable. But it really involves antibody deficiency by definition. But when I was in training, you know, I was trained to, oh, these don't show up until they're adults. You get a young adult with two or three pneumonias in a year, then, you know, they've got probably an antibody deficiency. But we always knew that there was sort of variability in children. It's like you have the kid that gets sick with every virus, right? And then I remember an old publication that said, oh, it's normal to have up to 13 infections a year. Well, they're constantly infected. I think we're recognizing now that some of those children do have an immune deficiency. It's not a dramatic one. And some of those kids go on in later life and develop a full-blown immune deficiency. Then we genetically test them and we can identify some of these immune deficiencies that are sort of not obvious. It's not like the bubble boy where they have severe infections, have to get a bone marrow transplant. That's the most dramatic, right? Mm-hmm. They have no immune system. But these more subtle immune deficiencies, I think we're recognizing more frequently and putting a name on it instead of like, yeah, your kid has too many infections. I don't know what to do about it. And most of them don't need to go on gamma globulin replacement or anything dramatic. We may use a preventive antibiotic, and that gets them through these vulnerable years. And then they tend to go through a period where they're healthy. But I see adults anywhere from their 20s up into their 70s having immune deficiency. And then I do the genetics and like, yeah, you've got a gene marker that probably, and some other testing, we can do more sophisticated testing of the immune system. We're recognizing that there are some sort of abnormalities and that have always been there. It just didn't manifest as an obvious immune deficiency. So I don't think it's necessarily on the rise. This concept of, remember I told you the story about the children had fewer colds if they had dogs. I think it's coupled with environmental influences that can predispose to an immune system that is not well developed. And most of the kids kind of grow out of it. And, you know, I study them. It's like, well, it's a little off, but it's not too bad. Let's just see what happens. And then eventually they get better and they stop having the frequent colds. And I don't know if that's a developmental issue with, again, for the same reason, the hygiene hypothesis, we're not exposed to enough microorganisms to help build the immune system, or whether there's something underneath it that really predisposes them to having mm-hmm. infections. I think you can have some of these genetic factors that may not ever manifest depending on environmental factors. And then, of course, you get back in the day, we would identify people died of smallpox, for instance. And I remember studying a family, the kid that we identified initially had a really severe chicken pox. And the infectious disease people said, this is unusual. Anyway, we ended up studying the family that had an immune deficiency. And back in the day, that, you know, a bunch of the kids died from smallpox. You know, mm-hmm. so bad infections can reveal, you know, where some people survive and others don't. And you think about it evolutionarily, when the Europeans came to the U.S., a lot of the Native Americans died from smallpox. Well, they had never seen that infection before. Did they have an immune deficiency? Well, yeah. I mean, everyone who died from COVID, did they have immune deficiency? No. But, you know, so there are just some bad infections out there. And part of that could be, you know, exposure, you know, our evolution. We've never seen that. Or there's new emerging bad bugs that are coming out that can kill even normal people. Or, and then there's differences in our immune system that might predispose to having a bad infection from a certain type of bugs. So I think our recognition of immune variability, probably a better way to say it, in individuals is gotten better. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily on the rise, but we certainly recognize the kid that has 13 infections a year in that old study, I would study him. I would do genetics on that patient and find out what it is that gives him 13 infections. And after that first year of school or daycare, if they continue to have the recurrent infections, that's a red flag. That's a flag that, okay, there's something going on here.
And that child should see an allergist or immunologist.
Yeah, all allergists have immunology training. So they, you know, all allergists in town should be able to evaluate them. If they turn out to have something really bad, they usually send them to me and Tony to, you know, because they're not as sophisticated doing the genetic studies and some of these more advanced studies. And of course, you know, getting them on the right medications, the gamma globulin replacement is sometimes difficult given the insurance issues. And sometimes I think they refer them to us because they don't want to deal with the insurance company.
Well, and of course, we're talking about Anthony Infante.
Yes.
Dr. Infante. Well, Dr. Ed Brooks with the University of Texas Health Science Center, thank you so much for being here back on the show on Pediatrics Now.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about pediatric arthritis down the road.
Sure.
Love to do an interview on that.
Yeah, be happy to. That'd be fun.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Ed Brooks. I appreciate you being here on Pediatrics Now.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Pediatrics Now. Click on the link for free credit if you're a practitioner. I'm Holly Waymont. I hope you can join us for our next episode.